You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the town of Peshtigo is suing marinette manufacturer Tyco and 100 other companies for damages stemming from PFAS water contamination. We'll talk with one resident who's been impacted, learn about a new PFAS mapping tool from the DNR. And we want to hear from you if this is an issue in your community. If you are trying to deal with PFAS pollutants, let us know what's going on. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Now, our next guest believes a sit-down meal sharing fine food with others might be the pinnacle of civilization. And he spent a lot of time making those meals at home and in restaurants. And he's also spent a lot of time, decades, pursuing another passion, painting. On this week's edition of Food Friday, Jacques Pépin shares the art of cooking and painting chickens. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an all-time favorite chicken recipe? Do you need advice on cooking chicken? Do you raise your own chickens? Love to hear your story. On the off chance, is there anybody out there who likes painting pictures of chickens? Tell us about it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jacques Pépin is a celebrated chef, TV host, author of a lot of books, including Essential Pépin, more than 700 all-time favorites from my life in food. His newest book is called Art of the Chicken, a master chef's paintings, stories, and recipes of the humble bird. Jacques, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That was a very glorious introduction of it, sir.
Well, you've had a pretty glorious career, so I think that's pretty fair. Now, I know you cook. I didn't know that you painted. How did you get started painting and painting chickens in particular?
Well, I started painting over 50 years ago. When I came to this country 60 years ago, actually, I have painting from the early 60s. I was at Columbia. I went to Columbia University here, and at some point I took a class in the sculpture, I think, and drawing. And we had a bunch of friends who had a house in Woodstock, New York, a kind of artist community. So we're all starting redoing all furniture and painting and so forth. So I guess it started there. And then eventually, I was married 54 years. And when people came to our house for over 50 years, we wrote down the menu that we had when we invited people, and they signed on the other page saying funny things and so forth. And I realized that I was illustrating those things very often with chicken head and so forth. So I started doing more chicken and other panning and so forth. So that's basically the way it started.
Now, chickens have been really important in your painting career and your cooking career. And you share a lot of stories in this book. And you were a kid in post-war France. Your family started a restaurant. And, things were scarce then. The chicken was a luxury item almost. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, my mother had a small restaurant. We had a few chicken in the in the backyard that we get them the peel of potato or whatever we didn't eat. But basically it was for the eggs, certainly as well as the chicken, at least the price. And the chicken occasionally, when my mother killed one, then she would boil it for a long time because it was a whole hand, and boil it and do something with the fat. First, we kept the fat of the chicken, certainly to saute potato or do other things instead of butter. And everything was used, the feet, the head, the liver, the neck, the gizzard, and so forth. So, the chicken in that sense is a very, very democratic, maybe the most democratic of all food, because you will find chicken in a truck stop, in a truck food, and as well as in any cafeteria or even in an hospital, but at the same time in a three-star restaurant with the truffle under the skin or whatever. You will find chicken in China, in West Africa, in Turkey, in India. Everywhere I've been in the world, I've had chicken. And eggs, certainly. People survive with eggs in a small country, with a bunch of it. So, yes, it's a very democratic and universal food.
And Jacques, in your teen years, you're 13, I think, you went to live and apprentice at a restaurant And you were sent to search for a piece of equipment I never heard of, a chicken boning machine. Can you tell us about that story?
Well, the point is that, you know, you all have rite of passage to go. And I started, I was the youngest apprentice. So that's usually they put a prank like that on the youngest apprentice. So the chef, you know, I came into that kitchen. I've never seen a mixer. There was a little mixer. There are a couple of electric equipment that I've never seen, a grounding machine. So the chef told me, you got to get the machine to bone out the chicken at that restaurant, whatever it was in town. So I rushed there to, of course, that was, and the chef told me, oh, wait a minute, we don't have it there. We just sent it to another restaurant, L'Escargot, which was another restaurant 20 minutes out of the way. I think the chef has it there. So I rushed back on the other side. And by then I get there, the chef told me, well, we have the machine, but you better hurry up because your chef is getting mad. You know, you've been gone for a couple of hours and all that. And watch out, we just wash it, so don't bang it too. And he gave me that big thick bag that I had to carry. And I carried and came around the corner where the hotel was that I was in apprenticeship. And I thought they were going to be yelled at. But on the other end, I saw the chefs and the waitress and people on the, you know, by the door waiting, and they were all laughing and all that. So that's when I had a doubt, and I opened the bag, which had two big stone in it. I mean, two cement block in it. So that was my rite of passage, you know. So anyway.
We're talking to Chef Jacques Pépin. His new book is called Art of the Chicken, a MasterChef's paintings, stories, and recipes of the humble bird. It's got stories, it's got recipes, and it's got his own paintings of chickens over the last 50 years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Michelle is with us in Ashland. Michelle, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I wanted to call in today because I helped my sister put paintings in gift shops, and she paints chickens, and the brighter the color, the faster the chicken will sell out of the gift shop.
Michelle, thanks for sharing that, Michelle. Jacques, it's hard to describe pictures out here, but you have a lot of bright colors, some fanciful chickens that are part chicken, part cabbage, things like that. Can you talk about your art and what you're painting a little bit?
Yes, I mean, but as I say, I love chicken. If you look at the back of that book here, I have a picture of me with a chicken on my shoulder, with two chicken on my shoulder. But yes, I do a lot of painting of flowers and even abstract too, but I do a lot of painting, and I got into the habit of doing a chicken who look like a cauliflower or a lettuce or a bunch of leek or whatever. So I kind of mix my cooking and my painting together of chicken, you know. So it's been fun. It's been fun doing it. And actually, I did not want to do a cookbook, and I just wanted to do an art book of my painting of chicken. And the publisher said, fine, but then after they said, well, we want recipe. And I said, well, I have 30 books of recipe. I don't want recipe. So I have a book called The Apprentice, which I published over 20 years ago, which is a cook's memoir, story of my life. So I did basically the same thing. I start writing story about chicken and about eggs when I was a kid, when I was in Africa, in one place or another, too. And I have some recipes, but those are in the narrative style. I'm sure some of them can be done. But I tell you, my mother used to saute this and that, and chicken, put a bit of this on that. And some. So you probably do it. Some other cannot be done with old style, using a cock's comb and cock's wattle and unborn eggs and sweet bread and pig's feet and so forth. Mm. So those are stories.
A great story I love that you associate a recipe with, a tarragon chicken. Now, you're in this apprenticeship. You're a little older now. You get woken up in the middle of the night. Some customers showed up, and the chef wasn't there. And this was your moment to make chicken. Could you talk about the tarragon chicken and how it went?
Right. It was at the Hotel de l'Europe, where I did my apprenticeship in Bourg-en-Bresse, and of course at the center of chicken country. So most of the dish we did in one way or the other were chicken. And one night some guest came from Paris, and around 10 o'clock at night, and the chef had left around 9:30. So the waitress came to my room to knock at the door. All the apprentices slept in a room above the kitchen. And I was the oldest apprentice at the time, even though I was like 15 years old. And they say, well, you have to come down. We have to have there is four people who want to eat. So I rushed to the stove. And fortunately, I still have some coal in the stove. At the time, it was coal and wood. So, and waited what they were going to order. They started by ordering a piece of pâté, which was great because the pâté was made. They just had to slice it, arrange it too. And then after they wanted a specialty, which was the chicken with the tarragon cream sauce. And it involved, cutting the chicken and sautéing in butter until slightly brown and finishing it with chicken stock and white wine, cooking it for 30 minutes and thicken it with a little bit of flour and butter and finishing it with cream and tarragon. And I did that as well as I could. And apparently the customer were happy. I was trying to look through the window. I mean, there was the door going to the dining room with a little round window. So, but then the waitress came and said, well, they want to meet the chef. I said, oh, that was my first exposure. So here came that kid, which was 15 years old, you know, so as the chef. So that was a bit of a, probably a bit of a surprise for them, you know, so. Anyway, that's not my first exposure to celebrity cooking. You know.
We're talking to master chef, TV host, author, and painter Jacques Pépin. It's Food Friday. We're talking about chicken. Jacques' new book is called Art of the Chicken, a master chef's paintings, stories, and recipes of the humble bird. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Jacques about his career making chicken, about his art, or do you need some advice on cooking chicken one way or another? He's done it many ways. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Don't forget the egg. He has some egg recipes too. 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with chef, TV host, author, and painter Jacques Pépin. It's Food Friday. We're talking about his latest book, Art of the Chicken, a master chef's paintings, stories, and recipes of the humble bird. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions for our guest, that's 800-642-1234. We've got a caller, Linda in Milwaukee. Linda, hi.
Oui, bonjour, monsieur. I just
How are you?
Bonjour, Monsieur Pépin. When I was a little girl, we lived in Brooklyn in New York, and I used to go with my grandmother to get the live chicken. They used to get it and have it killed for them. I wasn't allowed to watch that. But I remember that we used to get the chicken legs and the eggs, you know, the unborn eggs, and put that in the soup. And that made the best. You can't make chicken soup like that anymore, unfortunately.
Oh, Linda.
That was really special.
That's a great memory. Thank you for sharing that, Linda. Jacques, what does that make you think of?
Well, to make me think of my youth also. I used to have the unborn eggs too. You know, those recipes that you have or you eat as a child are very visceral. You know, they stay with you the rest of your life. Whether you come from Turkey, Africa, or China, Italy, or America, you know, whatever your parents or mother cooked, those tastes stay with you forever, you know, and that's what happened there. You know, those memories of food are very strong.
Thank you so much, Linda, for sharing that at 800-642-1234. We got an email. A Grant says, I poach chicken, either thighs or breasts often, but I still struggle to get them to be perfectly moist but not overcooked. Do you have any poaching chicken advice for Grant?
Well, if you poach the whole... See, the leg is going to take a bit longer than the breast, without any question. So if the chicken is whole, I tend to cut between the drumstick and the thigh. I make an incision with the knife so that the heat penetrates there faster, so I don't have to cook it as long for the leg to be totally cooked and not to overcook the breast. So it's very important too. I mean, I have a recipe. I think I have it in that book, given to me by Danny Kaye, the famous actor, you know, Danny Kaye.
Oh, yeah.
I cooked with him at his house. One time I came there and he said, I'm going to show you how to do a poached chicken, a chicken salad. You know? So he took a chicken and he opened his drawer and took a handful of spoon, fork, and stuff it inside and drop it in the stock pot. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm putting that in there so that the chicken doesn't come to the top. Then he covered it with water and salt, pepper. He put a lick in it, whatever, and bring it to a boil. And he boiled it maybe 3 minutes, 3-4 minutes, that's it. And he covered it and leave it on the side for 1 hour. Now, I have done that, and I think I mentioned that recipe in there. And you don't need to put the fork and spoon into the chicken to keep it in the bottom of the pan. But cooking it very briefly like this and leaving it in that hot broth for 1 hour, it produces a very, very moist chicken. Yes, and so we shred it out after to do a chicken salad. It was really good.
And you write in the book, fairly early on, the way a chicken is raised, actually, you say, makes a big difference in the quality of both the meat of the chicken and the eggs. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, of course. A free-range chicken is a happy chicken, eating grass, eating worm, going around. And that's no comparison with a chicken which is raised in a closed enclosure and eat only when the sound is atrocious. In addition, there is thousands of chicken. They kind of blind the chicken so that they don't kill one another to fight. And they put light on there because, as you know, a chicken, when the cock starts cockering in the morning, you know, and that's when the chicken wake up, and that's when they do an egg during the day. Well, because of the light, when there is no light, there is no egg. So in those places, they put light on top of the chicken so they can do two eggs a day instead of one. When you torture Mother Nature this way, you know, there is no way you're going to get great quality. So I would always advise people to buy organic eggs now. Frankly, it's not very expensive. It's a bit more expensive than the regular one, but when you break it down to pair eggs, it doesn't cost you more than like 40 or 50 cents for an egg. So yes, it's important to and for the quality of life of animal too, it's important not to torture those animals.
Talking to Jacques Pepin on this edition of Food Friday. His new book is called Art of the Chicken, A Master Chef's Paintings, Stories and Recipes of the Humble Bird. Got a lot of his own paintings and artwork, plus his stories, and of course, some recipes along the way. Jacques, you were just talking about eggs. Now, one of your stories here, I didn't know this, when you would have to go and audition and try to get a job at a new restaurant, very often what people would ask you to make was an omelet. Why an omelet?
Yeah, well, the classic omelette, you know, there is different way of doing omelette. I do at least four different types of omelette. But the classic French omelette that I do, where you move the eggs very fast, so that they are scrambled, like very, very finely scrambled, and you don't even let it brown, and you roll the omelette itself. It requires quite a lot of technique on a classic French cooking. So that's what I test, you know, when you work in restaurants in Paris. The chef will argue and say, why don't you make an omelette just to see how proficient you were with your skill. You know, so that's what I test.
Now, I'm never going to work in a French restaurant. What is the best way for a home cook to get a really good omelette?
Well, as I said, if you do the conventional omelette that you have in a cafeteria or diner, where you put the egg into hot butter and you stir them occasionally. You have large lumps too, and eventually you fold it in half and put it on the plate. You may fold it in half when it's still wet in the center or totally dry. It depends entirely on your own taste. Now, the classic French omelette is mixed, as I say, very fast, and it's very creamy inside, and it's not brown. There is no large curd. So it is different. It has a different taste. Is it better than the conventional omelette? Not really. It's just different. Some people will like one better than the other. And sometimes I'm in the mood for one. Sometimes I'm in the mood for the other.
Do you still paint chickens even after 50 years?
I still paint chickens. Yes, absolutely. I painted, I think, a couple last week. Yes, I did.
Now, so, I want to bring this home. You write about this at the outset. There's creativity, of course, in painting, and there's creativity in cooking and in the kitchen. So can you talk about how that's kind of a natural pairing for you to cook and paint?
Yes, it's a different type of thing, but certainly as a professional chef, and I've been a professional chef for over 75 years, so in the kitchen, when you are behind the stove and you have an order for you know, a chicken sauté with the mushroom, whatever, well, you don't have a recipe or whatever. You have the recipe that you do in that particular restaurant and all that in your head, and you start cooking it. If someone was behind you taking note exactly what you're doing, okay, 10 minutes later, you have another order for the same chicken. And let's say you do it 10 or 12 times during the evening, the same order of chicken. If someone who write those behind you yourself, you would realize that you haven't done it one exactly the same way. The idea is that, however, it come out the same way. It come out, the taste is exactly the same at the end, because as you start cooking, maybe the chicken breast is slightly thicker than the other, or the hot, or the pan is hotter, or whatever. It gets a little dry, so I put a tablespoon of water, which I may not do the next time. I do that. So the question is to cook, taste, adjust, and eventually that's in the end. Okay. So the reaction is always slightly different. You know, so there is that type of very personal interpretation in the cooking. And it's the same thing in painting, you know. So in painting, at some point, you paint a bunch of flowers, and the painting kind of take a hold of you, and you react to it, and you put that color there or that shape there, you react to it, and so forth. So there are similarities like that, some very intuitive type of thing.
Jacques, thank you so much for joining us again today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That's Jacques Pépin, celebrated chef, TV host, painter, and author of a bunch of books, including the one we talked about today on this edition of Food Friday. It's called Art of the Chicken, a master chef's paintings, stories, and recipes of the humble bird. Still time for you to share your stories, maybe your own art, if you have chicken-related art that you produce yourself, or maybe a cherished item up on a wall. Share it on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Check out a new effort here in Wisconsin aimed at helping families and kids in particular to overcome barriers and achieve success in the educational system, sometimes including families that have dealt with incarceration and the challenges that raises for kids going to school. Join the conversation. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on the show, I mentioned a conversation we had about doing things that we're bad at and that I had tried it lately by singing, which I am bad at. Well, here's another thing I am also bad at. Earlier today, I texted former Central Time producer Judith Sears Poisson. You may remember her. She was on the show a lot. She speaks French, by the way. I told her that Jacques Pépin was going to be on the show today. Her reply, quote, "Yes, I heard. Please don't try to say anything in French." Harsh, but fair, because I'm very bad at pronouncing French words. Now, for this job, I often have to say words or names or place names from languages that I don't speak, which is most of them. When it happens, I try to study up, then I give it my best shot. I think I mostly do okay. And then there's French. Doesn't come up that often, except on Food Friday, even if I'm not talking to a famous French chef. A lot of the words for techniques and equipment are French words. Judith tried her best to coach me, but here we are. I don't know what it is. I can't wrap my brain around it. I guess it's just some kind of je ne sais quoi. Sorry, Judith. This is Central Time.
You're listening to The Ideas Network from Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, the Friday News Roundup. We'll have the latest from Ukraine and the quest for a new British Prime Minister who can stay in office longer than the last one. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now we're checking in on several different headlines related to PFAS chemicals in Wisconsin. Often called forever chemicals, they're found in water as a result of various kinds of industry, and they're linked to a number of health concerns. This week, WPR News reported on a new lawsuit filed by the town of Peshtigo against Marinette manufacturer Tyco and 100 other companies related to water contamination in firefighting foam. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources this week also launched a new PFAS location information tool. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are these forever chemicals at issue in your community? Have you been dealing with contamination problems where you live? Have you had to get an alternate water supply? What questions do you have about what's going on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll start in the town of Peshtigo. Trigvi Root is a resident of the town and a member of the town's ad hoc water committee. He also sits on the Marinette County Board of Supervisors. Trigvi, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Can you start by describing how you've personally been affected by PFAS where you live?
Well, I'm in the town of Peshtigo, just a short distance out of the city of Marinette. I'm in the neighborhood that I've basically lived my entire life, three houses in the same neighborhood. But my home that I'm currently in has a contaminated deep water well. And I've been supplied bottled water. And also I have what's called a POET system installed on my water system to treat the water that comes into the house from my well. So I am, yes, absolutely, definitely impacted.
You're not, I understand, officially a plaintiff in this suit, but can you talk about the main argument now in this suit that the town has filed against these companies?
Yeah, from what I read, and I just read through this suit yesterday myself, like a lot of folks, the big issue is supplying the town of Peshtigo residents that have been impacted by this PFAS contamination is getting us a source of good, clean, permanent drinking water. And it's been a struggle. So the town has decided that suit to hopefully get the offending party to pick up the tab and get this moving was the way to go. So suit filed, and unfortunately these things don't move fast, but we'll see what happens.
Now, you're on the water committee. What is the mood like among, you know, your neighbors and other residents of the town around this water issue?
I think the biggest mood right now is people just want this over with. This has been going on since 2017. At that time, you know, back when we got letters from Tyco saying, you know, we know there's an issue. Your well may have contamination in it, and we want to come and check your well. Shortly after that, they offered that they would supply us City of Marinette drinking water to take care of this problem. Of course, here we are in 2022. We still don't have the City of Marinette drinking water. And so people are frustrated, and they want this to be over with, have a solution at this point in time.
And as we wrap up, Trigvi, are you hoping that you're going to end up with some kind of municipal water system as opposed to dealing with the well water?
Yeah, correct. I mean, the treatment systems that I and about 40 other residents have on our wells, it's addressing the issue, but it's not a long-term solution. These things are expensive to maintain. They're a hassle. I have someone here at my house probably 6 to 8 times a year doing maintenance on these things. So, yeah, the end goal is to have some sort of municipal water. The least expensive and the easiest is from the City of Marinette. So that's what we're all hoping for. It may not be what happens, but that would be the simplest and easiest.
Trigvi, thanks for sharing your story with us today.
All right, thank you.
Trigvi Root is a resident of the town of Peshtigo. He talked to us about his experience with PFAS contamination in his well and the new lawsuit the town filed against Tyco and 100 other companies for PFAS contamination. David Strifling joins us now, director of the Water Law and Policy Initiative at Marquette University. Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Good to be with you again. Thanks for having me.
What are your thoughts on hearing what Trigvi had to say and this town of Peshtigo lawsuit?
Well, it's quite a story, obviously, and it's something that Wisconsin's been dealing with for some time now, and I anticipate it's going to continue into the future. The thing about the lawsuit, and like Trevi, I've just been reading it myself as it's come out in the last couple of days, the lawsuit relies on what are called common law causes of action, things like nuisance, negligence, trespass, and The reason we have statutes like CERCLA, the Superfund law at the federal level, and the spills law at the state level, is that those kind of common law allegations can be difficult to prove. Causation specifically is often difficult. So, you know, it's not going to be easy for the town. I wouldn't give any opinion on the merits, but it's a difficult case to make.
In this kind of case, does it matter whether or not a company knew that these chemicals were potentially harmful? Or can they claim, yeah, we admitted them, but we didn't know at the time they were not that they were harmful?
So that's the big difference between, say, a suit in negligence and a suit under the federal CERCLA or Superfund statute. With negligence, it's a lot more difficult to prove a duty if the company can correctly say that they didn't know about it. Under the Superfund statute, you know, if the EPA were to come in and sue the companies under that law, there's no such requirement. A lack of knowledge is not a defense under that law. So, you know, from the town's perspective, I'm sure they would love it if EPA would come in or the Federal Department of Justice and sue the companies under the Superfund law. And EPA has taken some preliminary steps to allow just that possibility. It earlier this summer listed a couple of the PFAS chemicals as hazardous substances under CERCLA, which would allow that kind of a lawsuit. So, you know, much yet to be determined. And I would say that this lawsuit by the town is just kind of an opening salvo.
And we've seen a response from at least one of the companies involved saying, hey, we were negotiating in good faith, trying to come up with a solution. We didn't need this to go to the courts, in effect, in the first place. But we heard Trigby saying, you know, he was first notified in 2017 and is still waiting for solutions. Have you seen in other communities, Dave, successful accommodations without lawsuits causing them?
I can't. Nothing comes to mind. And often people file lawsuits when they just get frustrated with the pace of negotiations. You know, it's one more tool, I guess, that you have in your back pocket. And of course, we know that most lawsuits settle, so I'm sure the town would still like to negotiate with the companies and, you know, get them to cover the costs that the town thinks they should cover. Filing a lawsuit doesn't mean that that can't happen. It's just a way to hopefully accelerate the pace of negotiations, at least in some cases.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jennifer's with us in Marinette. Jennifer, hi.
Hello. Thank you for having me. So the reason I was calling was I think that there needs to be a good representation of what the majority of Town of Peshtigo residents want. Right now, we do not have that with our current town board. They are definitely the most vocal. But the majority of town residents are very frustrated with this litigation. It's going to cost the town. There are statements that are being made that it will not cost any of the town taxpayers, that Tyco will foot the bill for the water utility district forever. There are just claims that are not feasible. Currently, Tyco has been working very cooperatively with the town residents trying to come up with a solution. Right now, annexation to the city of Marinette is on the table. Individual deep wells is on the table. Even the town's plan was one of the options that was offered, but the majority of residents did not want that. So really, you know, the town is going against what the residents want, whereas Tyco is cooperatively working with us.
Jennifer, thanks for the call. We don't, of course, have surveys showing how many people on the town are on one side or the other, Dave, but not everybody is necessarily on the same page.
Yeah, and this is common when, you know, a plaintiff takes this kind of action in a municipality setting. Not everybody agrees. And like you said, I'm certainly not privy to the financial arrangements between the town and its lawyers or how many residents feel which way, but it's not common to have some difference of opinion on these kind of things.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for sharing your local perspective. We're going to continue talking about PFAS in Wisconsin, including a new PFAS location information tool from the state DNR. David Strifling, director of the Water Law and Policy Initiative at Marquette University, stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. The town of Peshtigo is not the only place in the state where this is a story. what's going on near you and your community. What solutions are you looking for? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk about PFAS news here in Wisconsin. The DNR just launched a new information tool that the public can access to find out about this kind of chemical contamination in their local community and testing and more. Earlier today, I talked to Mimi Johnson, director of the DNR's Office of Emerging Contaminants. What kind of data can we see in this new online tool?
Yeah, so we have four primary levels of data that are there. One is our PFAS sites, kind of where we know there's PFAS contamination, and that leans on our remediation and redevelopment programs data set. Another layer is our drinking water data, and currently that's all of our results from our 140 systems across the state that sampled through a voluntary sampling program this last year. We also have a layer of fish and consumption advisory data from our fish and wildlife program at the agency. And then our final layer of data is from our surface water database that has information about where we've sampled across all of the water bodies in Wisconsin.
Now, this is all available to the public. Who are you hoping uses this information?
Anyone. We really want to continue to have the conversation about PFAS. We want to put the information out there in as accessible a format as possible. And through this tool, if you want to get into the weeds into any of these data sets, it'll link you back to their kind of host site and area on our DNR web page so that you can really dive into the data. But at a bigger level, you know, this tool layers these pieces so you can just take a look at the whole state, or you can drill into a specific address as well.
And what are you hoping people do with the data on the online tool?
That's a great question. I mean, really just continuing to understand how PFAS might impact them, where PFAS might have been found across our state. And, you know, really just continuing, like I said, really having these conversations, trying to see how the data we have about the land and water in Wisconsin, you know, what that broader story is.
And will you be updating this? I imagine communities are going to continue doing testing in the days and months to come. Will that info then end up on this site?
Yeah, so that was one of our you know, kind of top priorities as we built this tool out, was to make it as automated as possible. So as we get new data inputs in the existing systems, it more or less just automatically will show up in this tool. The other piece being that, you know, as we continue to expand our monitoring efforts, like with our drinking water, with new drinking water standards, every public drinking water system in the state will begin sampling over the next 6 to 9 months. And so we'll start to have an even more complete picture of how PFAS may or may not be showing up in our drinking water systems across the state.
And I wanted to ask you briefly about another DNR program. The DNR announced a program to collect and dispose of PFAS-containing firefighting foam waste. This, I think, from practice sites. Can you tell us just a bit about that program?
Yeah, so that is the result of a $1 million investment in the biennial budget. We're jointly administering it with the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. It really came to be through a very strong partnership with our firefighting community. Our State Fire Chiefs Association and others have helped us engage with fire departments across the state. Many of them have recognized the dangers or potential risks of using PFAS-containing firefighting foam and just haven't had the means to be able to collect it and dispose of it. And so we're really excited about this opportunity to engage with our firefighting folks across the state. We'll at this point, we have just under 300 fire departments who initially responded to a survey that they had foam they wanted to get rid of. It'll likely be even more than that across pretty much all counties in the state. And we estimate we'll get several thousand gallons collected and disposed of through that program.
Mimi, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Great. Thank you for having me.
That was Mimi Johnson, director of the DNR Office of Emerging Contaminants. I talked to her earlier today about the DNR's new interactive tool giving people access to PFAS contamination info from around the state. We've got a link up at WPR.org/Central Time. Let's bring Marquette University's Dave Strifling back in. A couple statewide efforts there, Dave. It seemed like for a long time the PFAS issue was this community here, this community there. Are you starting to see a more coordinated effort at the state level and in other ways?
Well, I think this new interactive data tool is just great. You know, one of the most important things, in my opinion, that government can do is be transparent with people about the environmental risks they face, whether it's lead service laterals or air pollution or PFAS contamination or whatever it may be. Even if it's bad news, things that people don't necessarily want to hear, getting that information out there so we can react is critical. And in many of the environmental disasters that we've seen, that's one thing where government really failed. So, you know, I think this is great, and it allows anyone interested to try to put some of the pieces together in terms of where the contamination actually is. And the tool may not be perfect, it may not be complete, but it's definitely a step in the right direction.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Doug is with us in Marinette. Doug, hi.
Good afternoon.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, you're discussing what the company that caused the contamination in the Marinette and town of Peshtigo area knew and when they knew it. And I'd just like to point out that they discovered, their environmental consultants discovered PFAS contamination in the hundreds of thousands of parts per trillion on their fire technology center property in the fall of 2013. And then they retested 6 months later and confirmed that those results were accurate. And they did not inform anyone. They did not inform the DNR. They did not inform the public. And they did not submit any indication that this contamination was in the groundwater until the fall of 2016. So that's 3 years later. And then the DNR ordered them to start doing testing outside of their boundaries. And that in 2017 is when the residents in the area suddenly discovered they had poisoned wells. So this whole concept of we got a good corporate citizen that is trying to do the right thing, no, they're not.
Doug, thanks for the call. And Dave, Doug's timeline matches up pretty well with, I'm looking at our own Danny Kading's reporting on this, that delay between discovery and revealing this information to the DNR. What do you make of that?
Yeah, it's really tough to figure out motives sometimes in a case like this. Could just be a cover-up, could be time for investigation, could be that they just didn't know what they had on their hands. And until all the facts come out, and the caller is certainly making a good case that they should have done something sooner. And often when the facts come out, that's what we conclude, that something should have been reported sooner. And the timeline does match up pretty closely with my understanding as well of the investigation that DNR has got underway there.
Doug, thanks for that call. Dave, we've talked in the past about different, sometimes dueling guidelines on what safe levels of these chemicals are in different kinds of water. The state might say one thing, the EPA another, and now the World Health Organization came up with a much looser guidance. What are you making of their findings? This is creating some controversy.
Yeah, this is really interesting. So, you know, DNR just set the health advisory limits to 0.004 parts per trillion for PFOA this summer and 0.02 parts per trillion for PFOS. That's really close to the limits of detection, meaning if you detect any PFAS in your sample, you're probably going to be over those limits. The World Health Organization just put out a standard of 100 parts per trillion, so orders of magnitude higher. And, you know, I'm not a toxicologist or a chemist. I'm not sure yet exactly what went into making that standard so different, but that's what makes this so hard. When you have an emerging contaminant and you're not sure of the science, you know, you could be precautionary and set the limit really low at the risk of, you know, curbing some economic activity, or you can set it looser like the WHO did and say you want more proof. And, you know, where you end up is just a matter of policy, but that's where some of the disagreement comes in here with the scientific uncertainty.
And if I'm a company going to court over this, I might be really interested in those looser World Health Organization numbers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would think so.
In our last minute or so, Dave, what are you watching for next when it comes to efforts to stop and mitigate this problem?
Well, a couple of things. One is, you know, whether EPA is going to come out with a national drinking water standard. It sounds like that's in the works. And the other is that DNR has apparently restarted the process to promulgate a new groundwater limit for PFAS compounds. If you remember, that's one that was rejected by the Natural Resources Board last time around. So that's a longer timeline, 2 years to 30 months, but it's something to keep an eye on.
We'll leave it there, Dave. Thanks again for joining us today.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
That's David Strifling, director of the Water Law and Policy Initiative at Marquette University. We talked to him today about several PFAS-related stories, including the town of Peshtigo suing Tyco and other companies for damages linked to PFAS contamination. Plus, the DNR has a new interactive PFAS information tool where you can look at testing results, cleanup areas, and more around the state. Again, we've got a link to that at WPR.org/Central Time, and you can see if there are concerns in your own community. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, a lot of people switched to online shopping in the early days of the pandemic, raising questions. Will in-person retail stores have a role to play? Well, it looks like yes. It looks like in-person retail is bouncing back, according to some of the latest numbers. We'll check out the latest information on how we buy our stuff, and you can share your story if your shopping habits have changed and maybe changed back over the last couple of years. You can email right now, ideas@WPR.org. Plus, we'll get some insight on our health today by looking at the DNA of Neanderthals from 40,000 years ago. A UW researcher tells us about the latest findings, including some Nobel Prize-winning research. That and more, all coming up Monday here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.